Now Robin turned away from the two men, looked back at the land, and felt a small dismay to see it already sinking lower into the cold green sea. She yearned towards it with a quiet desperation, as she had ever since the day of departure so long ago. Her whole life in the intervening years seemed to have been a long preparation for this moment. So many obstacles to overcome, obstacles made mountainous by the fact that she was a woman. There had been so much struggle against temptation to give in to despair, a struggle that others had read as willfulness and vaunting pride, as stubbornness and immodesty. Her education had been gleaned with such toil from the library of her Uncle William, despite his act of discouragement. Too much book learning will only plague you, my dear. It is not a woman's place to trouble herself with certain things. You would do better to assist your mother in the kitchen and learn to sew and knit. I can do both already, Uncle William. Later, his reluctant and grumbling assistance changed only slowly into active support when he at last assessed the depth of her intelligence and determination. Uncle William was her mother's eldest brother, and he had taken in the family when the three of them had returned almost destitute from that far savage land. They had only the father's stipend from the London Missionary Society, a mere £50 per annum, and William Moffat was not a wealthy man. A physician at King's Lynn, with a small practice hardly sufficient for the ready-made family with which he found himself saddled. Of course, later, many years later, there had been money, a great deal of money, some said as much as £3,000, the royalties from Robin's father's books. But it had been Uncle William who had shielded and sustained them through the lean times. William had somehow found the money to purchase Zuger's commission in his regiment, even selling his two prized hunters and making that humiliating journey to Cheapside and the moneylenders to do so. With what William could raise, it was perforce not a fashionable regiment, and not even the regular army, but the 13th Regiment of Madras Native Infantry, a line regiment of the East India Company. It was Uncle William who had instructed Robert until she was as advanced in formal education as he was himself, and who had then aided and abetted her in the great deception of which she could never bring herself to be ashamed. In 1854, no hospital medical school in all of England would enroll a woman amongst their student body. With her uncle's help and active connivance, she had enrolled, using his sponsorship and the assertion that she was his nephew, at St. Matthew's Hospital in the East End of London. It helped that her name needed only changing from Robin, spelt R-O-B-Y-N, to Robin, R-O-B-I-N. That she was tall and small-breasted, that her voice had a depth and huskiness that she could exaggerate. She had kept her thick, dark hair cropped short and learned to wear trousers with such panache that ever since the tangle of petticoats and crinolines around her legs had irritated her. The hospital governors had only discovered the fact that she was a woman after she had obtained her medical qualification from the Royal College of Surgeons at the age of 21. They had immediately petitioned the Royal College to withdraw the honour, and the ensuing scandal had swept the length and breadth of England, made more fascinating by the fact that she was the daughter of Dr. Fuller Ballantyne, the famous African explorer, traveller, medical missionary and author. In the end, the governors of St. Matthew's had been forced to retreat, for Robin Ballantyne and her Uncle William had found a champion in the small, rotund person of Oliver Wicks, editor of the Standard newspaper. With a true journalist's eye, Wicks had recognised good copy, and in a scathing editorial had called upon the British tradition of fair play, ridiculed the dark hints of sexual orgies in the operating rooms, and pointed up the considerable achievement of this bright and sensitive young girl against almost insurmountable odds. Yet, even when her qualification had been confirmed, it was for her only a short step along the road back to Africa, on which she had determined so long ago. The venerable directors of the London Missionary Society had been considerably alarmed by the offer of the services of a woman. Missionary wives were one thing. were indeed highly desirable to shield the missionaries themselves against physical blandishments and temptations amongst the unclothed heathen. But a lady missionary was another thing entirely. There was a further complication which weighed heavily against Dr. Robin Ballantyne's application. Her father was Fuller Ballantyne, who had resigned from the society 6 years previously, before disappearing once again into the African hinterland. In their eyes, he had completely discredited himself. It was clear to them that the father was more interested in exploration and personal aggrandizement than in leading the benighted heathen into the bosom of Jesus Christ. In fact, so far as they were aware, Fuller Ballantyne had made only one convert in all his thousands of miles of African travel, his personal gun-bearer. He seemed to have made himself a crusader against the African slave trader, rather than an emissary of Christ. He had swiftly changed his first missionary station in Africa into a sanctuary for runaway slaves. The station at Kolobach had been on the southern edge of the great Kalahari Desert, a little oasis in the wilderness where a clear, strong spring of water gushed from the ground, and it had been founded with an enormous expenditure of the society's funds. Once Fuller had made it a slave refuge, the inevitable had happened. The Trek Boers from the little independent republics which ringed the mission station to the south were the original owners of the slaves to whom Fuller Ballantyne gave sanctuary. They called commando, the medium through which the Trek Boers dispensed frontier justice. They came riding into Kolobach an hour before dawn, dark, swift horsemen, 100 of them, dressed in coarse homespun, bearded and burned by the sun to the colour of Africa's dark earth. The bright flashes of their muzzle-loaders lit the dawn, and then the burning thatch of the buildings of Fuller Ballantyne's mission made a bright day. They roped the recaptured slaves together, with the station servants and freedmen, into long lines, and drove them away southwards, leaving Fuller Ballantyne standing with his family huddled about him, a few pathetic possessions which they had managed to save from the flames scattered at their feet, and the smoke from the smouldering roofless buildings drifting in eddies about them. It had confirmed in Fuller Ballantyne his hatred of the institution of slavery, and it had given him the excuse for which he had unwittingly been searching, the excuse to rid himself of the encumbrances which had until then prevented him from answering the call of the vast, empty land to the north. His wife and two small children were packed off back to England for their own good, and with them went a letter to the directors of the London Missionary Society. God had made his will clear to Fuller Ballantyne. He was bidden to journey to the north, to carry God's word across Africa, a missionary at large, no longer tied to one small station, but with the whole of Africa as his parish. The directors were greatly troubled by the loss of their station, but they were further dismayed by the prospect of having to mount what seemed to be a costly expedition of exploration into an area which all the world knew was merely a vast desert, unpeopled and unwatered, except around the littoral, a burning sand desert which stretched to the Mediterranean Sea 4,000 miles northward. They wrote hurriedly to Fuller Ballantyne, uncertain where exactly the letter should be addressed, but feeling the need to deny all responsibility and to express their deep concern. They ended up by stating strongly that no further funds, other than his stipend of £50 per annum, could be voted for Fuller Ballantyne's highly irregular activities. They need not have expended their energy and emotions. For Fuller Ballantyne had departed, with a handful of porters, his Christian gun-bearer, a Colt revolver, a percussion rifle, two boxes of medicines, his journals and navigational instruments. Fuller Ballantyne had disappeared. He emerged 8 years later, down the Zambezi River, appearing at the Portuguese settlement near the mouth of that river, to the great chagrin of the settlers there, who, after 200 years of occupation, had pushed no further than 100 miles upstream. Fuller Ballantyne returned to England, and his book, A Missionary in Darkest Africa, created a tremendous sensation. Here was a man who had made the transversa, the overland passage of Africa from west to east coast, who had seen, where there should be desert, great rivers and lakes, cool, pleasant, grassy uplands, great herds of game and strange peoples. But most of all, he had seen the terrible depredations of the slave raiders upon the continent, and his revelations rekindled the anti-slavery zeal of Wilberforce in the hearts of the British people. The London Missionary Society was embarrassed by the instant fame of their prodigal, and they hurried to make amends. Fuller Ballantyne had chosen the sites for future missionary stations in the interior, and at the cost of many thousands of pounds, they gathered together groups of devoted men and women and sent them out to the selected sites. The British government, prevailed upon by Fuller Ballantyne's description of the Zambezi River as a wide roadway to the rich interior of Africa, nominated Fuller Ballantyne Her Majesty's consul and financed an elaborate expedition to open this artery of trade and civilization to the interior. Fuller had returned to England to write his book, but during this period of reunion with his family, they saw almost as little of the great man as when he was in the depths of Africa, when he was not locked in Uncle William's study writing the epic of his travels. He was in London hounding the Foreign Office or the directors of the LMS. And when he had gained from these sources all that he needed for his return to Africa, then he was travelling about England lecturing in Oxford or preaching the sermon from the pulpit of Canterbury Cathedral. Then abruptly he was gone again, taking their mother with him. Robin would always remember the feel of his spiky whiskers as he stooped to kiss his daughter farewell for the second time. In her mind, her father and God were somehow the same person, all-powerful, all-righteous, and her duty to them was blind, accepting adoration. Years later, when the missionary sites chosen by Fuller Ballantyne had proved to be death traps, when the surviving missionaries had stumbled back to civilization, their fellows and spouses dead of fever and famine, killed by wild animals and by the wilder men whom they had gone out to save, then Fuller Ballantyne's star had begun to fade. The Foreign Office expedition to the Zambezi River, led by Ballantyne, had faltered and failed upon the terrible rapids and deep falls of the Kabora Bassa Gorge, through which the Zambezi crashed and roared, dropping 1,000 feet in 20 miles. Men wondered how Ballantyne, who had claimed to have followed the Zambezi down from its source to the sea, could not have known of such a formidable obstacle to his dreams. They began to question his other claims, while the British Foreign Office, parsimonious as ever, was considerably miffed by the waste of funds on the abortive expedition and withdrew the title of consul. The London Missionary Society wrote another of their lengthy letters to Fuller Ballantyne, requesting him in future to confine his activities to the conversion of the heathen and the propagation of God's word. Fuller Ballantyne had replied by posting them his resignation, thereby saving the society £50 per annum. At the same time, he had penned a letter of encouragement to his two children, urging them to show fortitude and faith, and sent the manuscript in which he vindicated his conduct of the expedition to his publisher. Then he had taken the few guineas that remained from the huge royalties that his other books had earned, and had disappeared once more into the interior of Africa. That was 8 years previously, and no one had heard from him since. Now here was this man's daughter, already nearly as notorious as the father, demanding admission to the society as a working missionary. Once again Uncle William had come to Robin's aid. Dear, mild, bumbling Uncle William, with his thick pebble spectacles and wild grey bush of untamable hair. With her he had gone before the board of directors and reminded them that Robin's grandfather, Robert Moffat, was one of the most successful of all African missionaries, with tens of thousands of conversions to his credit. Indeed, the old man was still working at Kuruman and had only recently published his dictionary of the Sechuana language. Robin herself was dedicated and devout, with medical training and a good knowledge of African languages taught her by her now deceased mother, daughter of the same Robert Moffat. And by virtue of the reverence with which he said Robert Moffat was regarded by even the most warlike African king, Mzilikatsi of the Indibele, or, as some people called them, the Matabili, the granddaughter would find immediate acceptance amongst the tribes. The directors had listened stonily. Then Uncle William had gone on to suggest that Oliver Wicks, the editor of the Standard, who had championed the girl against the attempt by the governors of St. Matthew's Hospital to deprive her of her medical qualification, would be most interested in their reasons for refusing her application to the society. The directors sat up and listened with great attention, conferred quietly, and accepted Robin's application. They had then seconded her to another missionary movement, who in turn sent her to the industrial slums of northern England.